let's get the COVID stuff out the way, the quarantine stuff. How are you and the family surviving this craziness?
Just divvy up at the beginning of every day. Wife goes to one office, a table in the house. I go to mine. Son goes to his. Does schoolwork and goes outside and has baseball practice. And everybody grabs lunch when they can and just, you know, have dinner. And everybody has dinner the same. We have dinner every night together. And then go our separate ways or, you know, split up into twos and ones at some point of the evening and just, you know, it's just a day. They go quick. The days go really quick. I can't believe it's already Friday tomorrow. It's been strange.
Yeah, you almost get to the point where you forget what day it is during the week because you're like, well, it doesn't really matter until I get to either the end of the week or the beginning of the week.
Well, see, but I had, you know, so I started a new job, right, as this was all happening unexpectedly in terms of the timing. The new job wasn't unexpected, just certainly didn't expect it to begin in the midst of a pandemic. So it was just, you know, everything changed like a lot at once, but kind of what was happening in the world reminded me that my personal changes were really insignificant and really, where I work is the least of anybody's concern. So, you know, it will remind you that you got to get back in and start doing your business and start, you know, helping out. So it's been an interesting experience for sure. How about you? How are you doing?
You know, surviving, it's definitely a little weird. I'm now a courier, so I got the job well before the pandemic, and then all of a sudden the job changes with the pandemic where it's a lot more kind of in the line of fire, if you will. So, like, we visit old age homes, so for me it's kind of, it's a little weird with that, but it's made me much more aware of things, too. So, kind of a blessing in disguise in that factor, but the biggest thing for us...
What is your day like? I mean, what do you do? So, who are you taking stuff from and to, and who do you give it to, and who do you see and talk to and interact with? I mean, you're really clearly a correspondent from the front lines.
Well, luckily, we get the stuff from, like, the pharmacies, and then we don't deal with anyone really inside the facilities anymore. We usually go straight to the nurse outside, or they come to us. So it's not as much interaction as it used to be. But as far as those places being on lockdown, they are kind of like by far the places most fearful of getting anything inside. So there's one place that I go to in Abilene that is, you know, we don't even enter the facility, and it's basically just, you know, what do you expect? Masked people coming out and taking our bags, and then we run away from each other as quickly as possible. I wouldn't say it's helpful to, like, I feel really bad for nurses that have to be in facilities. Like, luckily we're not anywhere like that, but getting to kind of allow the nurses to at least have a moment of, I get out of the place, I can tell that each and every one of them that comes out is kind of thankful just for that 1 second of not doing what they're normally doing, kind of being fearful.
Definitely. Do you visit with them?
I've gotten to know a few of them. Yeah, I do kind of talk to them a little bit and give them as much time as I can, because we're so timed by our routes where we don't have too much time. But some of them I've gotten to know really well. I mean, I see them either every day or you know, every weekend or something like that. So I definitely feel like if I can give them 5 minutes of a conversation that's not medicine related or patient related, you know, we're kind of their outlet. You know, the question I get the most is like, so has anything crazy happened outside of COVID news? Like, anything going on? And a lot of them know that I do the blog stuff, so they ask about is there any updates on when theaters will open, and I try and give them as much info or give them a new show to watch or something like that that they can get on when they get home, because they're very much not only isolated at work, but they have to be isolated at home as well, which I don't think a lot of people realize. Like, when they're off, they can't even really go see family and friends. They have to isolate themselves in case they get it outside of work as well. So,
right.
They're definitely home-bodied, like no one can...
So who does their grocery shopping for the nurses who work in the senior care facilities?
Usually the there's like a dozen, like for some certain of them, I know they get like the janitorial services. They've started to do pickup orders whenever they come in. But a lot of them make their own food and do their own, like, bring in their own food. A lot of businesses, amazingly, have stepped up and have sent food. I know during the weeks, like, during the weekdays, like, a lot of them get sent, like, you know, huge catering-style service from local businesses. But, I mean, from what I understand, a majority of them are eating at home like we all are. They kind of have stocked up, and they're doing, a lot of them do Instacart, for instance, and I mean, yeah, it's definitely a wild thing, because I know they don't like eating at the facilities, because there are kitchens and stuff at the facilities, but I think a majority of them like to bring their food from at home, or know that it's not in contact with anyone, they're not bringing anyone in contact, or the patients aren't in contact, so it's pretty scary.
Somebody's making a documentary about them.
Really? Well,
That's a great movie. You make a film about the people that you go visit every day.
Are you finding yourself with this? I mean, obviously, you haven't been able to dive into the new day-to-day work at Heritage, but like now that you're no longer with one of the papers, I mean, are you starting to think of, like, doing a documentary, doing different things that maybe you didn't have time to?
I'd love. I mean, I'm suggesting, I'm putting it out to anybody that, you know, to you, you know, take a camera with you. Seem like you should capture some of the imagery of these people and talk to them and really shoot a nice little short film about it. I mean, that really is the front lines. I mean, you're like a courage soldier. You are a courier delivering to the front lines of, you know, of the, it just seems like a pretty front row seat kind of thing. So, would you ever have an interest in doing that?
Oh, I would love it. Getting to, I think nurses would be game for it too. I mean, maybe not whole interviews and stuff, but I think people are interested in what exactly is going on, because there's so much yelling back and forth from the angry, loud people on both sides. I don't think the reality gets out there to the public, and it would be nice just to be like, here's who they really are. They're not anyone different than us, but they're in really crazy situations, and they're handling it with I don't know, I have a lot of respect for these people, and it's not just because I, you know, they're surviving, I think it's because they're staying sane as well, which has got to be something that hopefully when it dies down we'll get a little bit more of a response to, but I'd be game for that, yeah. Well, I've got to ask you, with this new job, I mean, I'm kind of curious, did they approach you, or did you approach them because of the chance to, I know you're a history buff, especially with our city and with your family's legacy. I mean, was that kind of something that sparked your connection to them, or, you know, what made you get out of, I mean, you've
That's
been
funny when I saw Jim Halpern, co-chairman, sometime in January, he said that he had been trying to get me for 12 years. I think I'd done my first story about Heritage 15, 20 years ago when they had come. We were across the street from each other. I was on Maple and Heritage was on Maple. So I'd gathered meet one of the guys while I was at one of the restaurants around there. We got to talking about heritage, and he invited me up to see the place. And I was amazed, you know, for Stan Lee and the Cage that sold their collections. And all the, you know, Stan Lee's complete collections laying around at the time. I was like, geez, you know, it's kind of like the pages of the Bible were literally scattered around my feet. So from that moment on, I was kind of like amazed and interested and eventually smitten with it. So, you know, when they started looking for somebody to do this, I clearly was interested.
What is that, Bill?
I had been ready for such a thing. Yeah, because it's not a lot of the, you know, this is my wheelhouse. Comic books, baseball cards, sports collectibles, movie memorabilia, music memorabilia, guitars, you know, photographs. I mean, I'm sitting in my office, which is full of framed pieces of one-of-a-kind artwork that are mostly pop culture. So, yeah, it's kind of the place for me.
Well, I know you started way back in the day as you know, with music. I'm curious if... I know you're still a huge music buff. I mean, you did that wonderful AstroTurf documentary with Steven and them. What has music meant to you in your life and being able to see music come to Dallas? I mean, you've seen some really epic, fun shows, and what has it meant to you personally?
Well, I like being part of a city that has such a rich history. I was very fortunate when I was a music writer to be writing about it and going to shows and being around bands who were my age, who were incredibly talented and fun to be around. Peter Schmidt in Funland, Clark Vogler, Will Johnson at the time, certainly the guys in the Toadies, the women of the Toadies. You know, it was really, I was bedhead, I mean, for God's sakes, to have lived at a time when the Condane Brothers were playing shows on a semi-regular basis in Deep Ellum. It was a great moment to be a music critic. So, it was really it taught me a lot. It made me fall in love with music all over again, having gone to a lot of shows in high school. So, you know, plus the 100 years that came before it, going to the Dallas Jug Band and beyond. we should be very proud of our city's rich and varied musical history that seldom gets discussed.
You know, Robert, you've spent so much time here in the city. I mean, I know you went out to L.A. for a little bit, but when you decided to come home, I mean, is this the place that you're meant to be? I mean, have you ever thought about going somewhere else? I mean, I know your writing could have carried you, honestly, anywhere you would have wanted to go, but you've always stayed with us.
Well, I mean, look, I'm a bit of a cliche, but my love for the city of Dallas, how all the stuff I own is city branded. I am a one-man visit Dallas. But yeah, look, I mean, when I was a journalist, I felt, when I lived in Los Angeles in the mid-90s, I felt like I was a fraud writing about a city I didn't, know very well. I mean, I knew LA from popular culture. I knew it from movies. I knew it from songs. I knew it from seeing pictures of it and reading books about it, but I didn't really know it. And by the time I got there and got to know it, it was a strange and weird and wonderful place, and I really enjoyed it. And I also felt like I just didn't belong there as much as I really liked it, and kind of wanted to come home and write about Dallas. So I felt like, you know, you should know the place you were writing about and care about it and be vested in it. So it was very important for me to come back here to write about the city at the time that I did. That said, I really miss LA. It was a lot of fun.
I know.
It was super fun.
I couldn't imagine. I mean, especially the 90s, there was so much going on.
Well, the 90s, it was really great to live in L.A. in the mid-90s when Jerry Seinfeld was dating Shoshana Lonsdale, and you'd see them around. We actually were with just a random Saturday screening of Swingers with Shoshana Lonsdale and Jerry Seinfeld sitting in front of us, and John Landis, the director of Animal House and Blues Brothers, and Trading Places sitting there. It was surreal. Yeah, it was fun. You go to parties and Ben Stiller would always be there. It didn't matter where you were. Jeff Lyles had also just moved there at that time, so had Kim Pendleton and Paul Craig and Vivalux, because their band had gotten a development deal with Capitol Records, I want to say. No, it was Capitol Records. Vivalux. So we were all there at the same time. I saw Jeff a lot. Jeff introduced me to Ian Copeland, the manager of the Police, went to a party at his house. Jeff took me to really weird places. It was great. But I saw in L.A. I would not have otherwise seen if Jeff Lyles had not moved to L.A. at the same time. And then he moved back around the same time. It's weird. It would be realized how connected Jeff Lyles and I are.
Which is crazy, because if you look at each other's hair, they're very different styles you guys have got.
Well, it's just because I lost it. Jeff kept his hair. I didn't keep my hair. Jeff, and Jeff treated it well, you know? It was good now.
Oh, it looks great. It's a staple, I think, for us that follow Jeff, yeah. You know, when I started The Observer was just after you'd kind of gotten Unfair Park going to what it became. I'm curious, and
what it was completely forgotten.
I know it's sad, but I'm kind of curious. Being when you moved to the morning news, you were on the digital side as well. How early did you realize that you needed to kind of look at the digital online side for papers, because obviously they're struggling like crazy, but I mean, it seemed like you were ahead of the movement.
Well, I mean, the blog was easy. Unfair Park just sort of took shape, and I have to say it really came together really well, just with the right people at the right place at the right time, trying to do something that we'd never done before. I remember the meetings we used to have on Maple, talking about Unfair Park, talking about the blog and how it came to be. I remember it was Matt Pulley, who's now in Nashville, who actually came up with the name Unfair Park. It's like, holy shit, that's the right thing. It was just, I'll never forget, we were all sitting there. I think at one point I proposed calling it Big Grackle. And making this old English-looking, Poe kind of fontish thing that would be there. But we went instead with, and then Alex Flores did a beautiful job designing the logo. I mean, really, I have one of the old advertising placards, the corn dog, and take another bite. It was, that was I have to say, that was a thing on Unfair Park. I mean, I don't think anybody I worked with at Unfair Park during The Observer at that time, whether it was Patrick Michaels or Andrea Grimes or Ann Zimmerman or any of the folks I worked with, I don't think any of them would look back on that and go, oh, that was the golden days. That was Rolling Stone in the 70s, Esquire in the 50s. I don't think anybody would ever look back at it. But I have a real fondness for that period. 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006. Because D had done Front Burner before we started. And it was really good. It was a little chatty. It's nothing like it is now. In fact, Front Burner did better recently on Fair Park used to, back when Front Burner was what it started as. It's funny, I think they adopted a lot of what we started. And I'm not saying ours was revolutionary by any stretch. I'm just, it's funny how it all kind of turns into the same thing at the end of the day. Everybody looks the same. Unfair Park looks like everything looked exactly the same now. That said, I was pretty proud of what we did. The really good reporting, the good artwork, the right blend of, you know, I don't want to say snark, because it was never snarky. But that was real popular in the early 2000s, snark. And I kind of wanted to avoid it, just like cursing. I didn't like cursing. I used to say motherfucking or, oh, cluster fudge. That was the thing I used to say. And people were like, you know, too chicken shit to say clusterfuck. And somebody very accurately, I'll never forget it, in the comments said, no, it's because he can curse. He curses without cursing, and it's nice. And that was exactly right. So I just really liked it. It was Friends of Unfair Park. We had meetings. I mean, we had a party once, and we met people. And I knew who the commenters were. I know who Wiley H is. He used to meet for drinks. It meant a lot. It's weird. I've never really sort of thought about how nostalgic I am for that period 16 years ago, but it was great. It's weird, though. Unfair Park consumed my every moment. Like, I treated it as seriously as Charles Foster Kane treated his newspapers. Mm. Like, I really rode the writers, you know, and I was... Nobody believed in the online freebie at that point. Plus, they don't come to work at a weekly newspaper when they have to suddenly work on daily deadlines. And I got that. But I was still kind of a dick about it. I think, I hope time has softened the edges till it just becomes acceptable enough not to be that asshole. But, you know, it was hard. But I really loved it. Like, everywhere I went, everything I did made me focus. Everything around me was a blog item. It made me so curious about the city. I learned more about Dallas and its politics in the last 15, 16 years than I owe that largely to Unfair Park. So, and Shoots is still there doing it, and he's mostly right on target and mostly doing it with great humor and occasional glimpses of real beauty. So that's good enough.
Well, as a poor college kid, it was the only thing we could care to read that we weren't, that's the man telling us what is out there. So I know I appreciated it. So thanks for not treating it as something like other newspapers or other entities did. You guys did seem to create something unique.
We took it seriously. I took it seriously, and over time, everyone took it seriously. Like, people would go to meetings late at night. They would go to places. You know, it really became, and it was 10 items a day, too. I'll never forget. Like, today, The Observer still has sort of a vestige of the blog. And if you go to Hunter Park, I think you can actually still reach it that way. But it's 2 or 3 or 4 stories posted every morning at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they're never changed. Like ours, we started on one of our first posts was at 6:30. There'd always be one per hour for the next 10 posts. And I really took it seriously. It was, we loved it. I mean, I think everybody tried to outbite each other. I sort of viewed it like The New Yorker, but like relatable and stupid. It was a continuation of something I studied in college at the Daily Texan, with guys who went on to be great.
Do you mind if I ask about Austin in the late 80s, 90s, what it was like?
Is it possible I can put you on hold for a sec?
Yeah, go right ahead.
All right, thanks.